I can hold my knife with my left hand, so that I can
use. That's where it comes from. You don't want that.
Perfect. Okay. Y'all ready?
Yes.
Maybe this is what we pass around.
Okay. A little bit of time.
And so, again, because it's not going to see your face, we're going to do your name every time and your pronoun, like when you talk and answer the question. But let me start by doing a little intro. Okay, so this is Jay. I'm with the 2025 VVN Community Food Systems Fellows. We're in Chaumont and recording a story circle related to our experiences around food sovereignty movement work. It is, what's today, October 22nd, 2025. And yeah, we'll start. Our first question is, tell a personal story of an experience that shaped your commitment to food sovereignty.
Thank you. Nikia McDonald. My name is Nikia McDonald. I am from Arkansas. My pronouns are he, him. And my story. So it's like maybe three stories in one. I think the last time I was here, I started telling you all about my grandfather. And so my grandfather, like I said, he used to go and make deals with like the grocery stores and take the food from the grocery stores and bring it out in the community. Well, when I was a little boy, I think I was maybe in the fourth or fifth grade, it was during tornado season, and Arkansas is part of, you know, somewhat part of Tornado Alley. And there was a tornado getting ready to form not too far from where our land is, right? So you look out and there's a hill, and right on that hill you see this funnel cloud getting ready to form into a tornado. And everybody is panicking because it's coming right towards where my family land is, and it's gonna destroy everything. And my grandfather saw it. So let me give a little background. My grandfather's name was Willie Rochelle, and he was born with what in Black tradition they call a veil over his eyes. And the reason why that's important to Black people in the South mainly is because it's said that the children that are born with veils over their eyes has very, they're spiritually gifted, or they spiritually see, you know. And so he was born that way. His nickname was Dub, and I'll give the second story about, well, the part of the story about him being a Dub, him being Dub later. But he was called Dub because he would crawl backwards when he was a baby, right? Like a dung beetle. And so they called him Dub. And so my grandfather, going back to the story, my grandfather's standing there calm. Everybody else is like, oh my God. And he tells me and my cousins and my little brother and my sister and all of us, he tells the grandchildren, run in the house, get the family Bible and a wood axe, right? And we're like confused, but we go and get it. So we come back out with it. He has my grandmother read something out of the family Bible. He does something in the ground. He says something, does something in the ground. And he takes his axe and he chops in the ground in the direction of the tornado. And the tornado splits. Right, and one goes this way, tears up everything. One goes that way, tears up everything. And we're just sitting there amazed, like, how did he, what just happened? And so he tapped into a tradition in order to save the land, basically save everything. And we knew it was a tradition because shortly thereafter, the local bootlegger came racing down the road in his car, and he pulled up in the driveway, and he says, Mr. Dub, that was you that split that tornado? And my grandfather was like, yes. He was like, man, I'm so glad you knew what to do, because I was chopping all in the ground. I ain't know what to do. So he knew that this, you know, this tradition. And so for years, I would tell people this, and they would tell me I was crazy. And it wasn't until I started talking to people who were steeped in the African tradition, they were like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's normal. Yeah. That's. And so it just showed me, one, his power, you know, and how he used that to defend the land, you know. And so years later, he had made his transition, and me and my mother, my mother now lives in the family house. And so me and my mother sitting there, we had painted the house. We painted it yellow, because that was my grandmother's favorite color. And me and my mother sitting there, and she says, what do you think your grandfather would have thought, you know, of how the house looked and all that stuff? And as we're saying that, I see something flying in front of me. And I was like, and I, you know, pay attention to it. And it lands right at my feet, and it's a dung beetle. Mm-hmm. Wow. It's a beetle sitting right in front of me.
Wow.
Like him coming back and saying, okay, I'm here, I'm present. And so just his work, who he was as a person, how he, you know, made an effort to make sure nobody went hungry. Because he also owned the store. I think I told you all about the store and all that. But that's what pushed my food sovereignty work. That's what, you know, pushed the work, because he was just a living example of this is not only just making sure people have food, but also this is your culture, right? You know, seeing him do that was just a reminder of, you know, protecting your culture, which is part of the food sovereignty work that I think gets lost sometimes, is the cultural component of it. And so, yeah.
Thank you.
I think I might have to pass. I'm sorry. Not even more.
Hey.
Apologies.
I'm unsorry.
Yes.
Take this off, because I feel like wearing headphones gives me the same effect as wearing sunglasses, where I don't feel like
here. Okay, yeah. Actually, I have a story. I can go. I just, it's much shorter.
Yeah.
But that was fine. Like very powerful. So, may I have the stick?
Take the stick.
My name is Jamela Anderson. I'm from upstate New York. My pronouns are they, them. I think for me, this is definitely going to be much shorter, but I think for me personally, where I come into this work is for the exact opposite of what Nakia just shared, which is that I am a product of adoption in my family. My mother is adopted. My mom is biracial, and we don't really know anything about our history. And I've shared this many times with y'all. So for me, there is a lot of disconnect to my ancestral roots. And even on my father's side, where I'm very present with my father, and there has been some disconnect along, you know, the past few years, but we are connected. But it's in our family, there is no tradition of passing on anything. I have no stories of people who look like me, the blood I share with them, like the, you know, the DNA that we share. I don't have any of that. And for me, it feels as if I'm beginning that. And so it's like my journey to share what I learn. And so in this lifetime, I am doing research, and I am starting the book that we don't have. And a lot of the work that I do is rooted in food as a common language. That's like food as a universal language is like sort of the thing that we work, the arch that we work under and the work that I'm doing personally. And in the work, I have been connected to so much ancestry that is mine, whether it's direct or not. And I'm learning so much from the cultures that I was not brought up in. My whole history has been whitewashed. And like, admittedly, I didn't even recognize that I'm Black until I was like in my 20s, because it didn't dawn on me that I was so disconnected. So food sovereignty work is that reckoning with the history that I was not offered, that I was not given. And so I am taking it, I am writing it, I am creating it, and I am passing it on. And so I am that, like the living work of that. And so food really just does connect all of us so much. And I don't think that I would be able to say what I'm saying without, you know, without having that network, that creating this network, being a part of this network, being in the group with you all. And so each of your stories that you share for me become my ancestry, because I am connected to you. I am connected to everybody. And so like, it is really profound to be able to hear you, to witness, to be present, and to exchange, because it's helping me write my story. So thank you.
Thank you.
I know.
Okay, this is Jay. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm also from upstate New York, the Mohicanoic land. I think there's so much to name here about a story that shaped my commitment to food sovereignty. I feel like I first want to do ground setting around, I really connect to what Jamela was saying around kind of just like not knowing ancestry, but like in a different way, because as a mixed race person, one side of my family that's from the Andes movement and moving away from ourselves, our traditions, was such a tool and strategy for survival. And so I always meet that with a lot of grace through that pain. So like my great grandma on that side is like Quechua, which is like one of the biggest indigenous cultures and also the biggest like indigenous language that's still spoken worldwide today, and had so much land there. And because of like colonization and xenophobia, racism, right, was like pushed to not pass down so much of her own self into her lineage. And so with my grandmother, she spoke the language, but eventually had to move from the mountains and countryside and move to Lima and to find like work and try to survive in like the cities, which is like one of the biggest cities in Peru. And it still wasn't enough, because then my dad had to come to so-called US and try to plant roots here to try to survive. And so there's just always just like needing to move to like try to find more to be able to like live, and all of that, like, I feel like you're also moving away from yourself. And so there's a lot of grief and pain when it comes to thinking about how my identity is like wrapped up with connections to like land and home on that side. And then on the other side of my family, where there's like a lot of like white, I guess like rural people, and like still people I'm trying to figure out how to have relations with. They also come from land stewards, interestingly enough, from what I know. And there's also like a lot of like pain and grief in a different way of like wanting to not be connected to oneself. And I think I lay all this context because I feel like where I'm right now feels like such a full circle moment of just like returning to, because I'm so interested in learning things and having conversations with my family that are now opening doors for them to like want to also reconnect with things that they didn't give themselves permission to previously. And that's always done for me, at least with the land, which I think is connecting me to like food sovereignty, because food sovereignty is wanting us to return to so much of our like indigenous, so much of our knowledge systems, and knowledge systems of our indigenous relatives. And also at the same time, there's only so much that we can restore to. Like, there is, you know, we can't fully decolonize, we can't fully, we've been changed and we change every day. And also I'm someone that without imperialism, colonization, all these things, I also wouldn't exist. Like, I don't know who I would be. And so there's like a lot of grief in figuring that out. But I also always know that like within that, I've found the land to be kind of just like the safe space to like land and remember, because I think of where I came from. And so my favorite memory is growing up in upstate. We lived in like this rural area, and I was in this like very safe container when I was like 5, because I wasn't in the outside world yet. Like, I hadn't encountered like all of these like outside systems, because it was just me in my little yard in the creek with all the animals and like catching fish. And I was so brave and I felt so safe, and I always return to that because it always reminds me of like who I am, how I always feel when I have those containers, you know, beyond what we're putting when we go outside of the world, whether it's because of like race, gender, you know, all of these things. So yeah, I think about that. I think about like a return home with sovereignty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I still feel like I don't know what to say. Jordan Smith, originally from Missouri. I get to call Hawaii home. She, her pronouns. This is a little big question. I feel like it's hard to tell. I'm talking to this. What feels like to tell one story. I feel like my whole just like being and getting to live in Hawaii and be in a different host culture that's just completely different from like my background or anything that I've ever experienced, I don't know if I would be in this work if not for that, for that privilege. And I think that's probably just the big old story of really learning and seeing what food sovereignty means. And I think my takeaway from Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander culture is just like, is the connection to food that I didn't have growing up. And like, right, it's not food, right? It's family. Like, it's literally their younger brother, their younger sibling, and like that connection. And then being able to see and experience the strength that comes from knowing where you come from and knowing, like Nikia was saying, your cultural practices. Like, I think I envied that for a long time, and feeling like I didn't have that, right? Like, I've never gone back past my great-grandparents. And I don't know why. I feel like probably just because I think it's too painful or like too hard, or it might not even exist. And so I feel like getting to live in Hawaii and work amongst the community, just that knowing, that remembering, and knowing like that's how it could be for everyone, and knowing and seeing how better things could be. I think really radicalized me for real, y'all. Like, before that, like, I didn't like know where my food came from. I didn't really have connection to the land. And yeah, just being there, just listening and watching and learning, inspires me every day, pushes me every day.
Thank you. Thank you. Get to mic the mic. Alrighty, so my name is Ty, I have she, her pronouns. So food sovereignty, how I got into it. Basically, I wanted to be the change I wanted to see. I can agree with others that I just didn't have that connection, or, and I just wanted, you know, I grew up with a toxic mother, you know, as well. And it's just like, I just wanted to be the difference, you know. I found love in being outside in nature. That was my escape place, and that was what I enjoyed. You know, I used to watch Steve Irwin and all these things like that and be like, that's just what I loved. Like, I was that girl that was outside in the ditch. So I just wanted to offer that happiness to someone else. Like, maybe if I feel like this in this setting, growing things and being amongst nature, maybe I can cultivate this for other people. So my escape from a toxic situation probably could be the same for others. I'm a giver by nature, you know, I'm a Virgo. And that's just what I love doing. I bartend as well, so it's like I love making people food. I love giving people drink, and I love having a good time surrounding it. So again, if I could recreate that environment for those who maybe don't have the space to escape, then, you know, that's why I called my organization Cultivating Culture. I wanted to cultivate that for people. So that's how I got into food sovereignty, just trying to recreate that safe space that, you know, we need to return to. Like, you know, you good here, friend. That's all I got to say about that. So, yeah.
Hello. My name is Ellie, and I go by she, her pronouns. This is like a hard question for me to like get to, because I feel like in talking about my work, it's like I have to go back to like how I got here and all of that. So my mom came from El Salvador when she was 6 years old. Her whole family fled the civil war there. And, you know, a lot of trauma, a lot of like fear, paranoia, was sort of brought with them. And so there was a lot of fear associated with El Salvador, but also pretty much anywhere like in Latin America. And because of where, you know, they came here directly to like Cambridge, Mass, Somerville, Mass, at that time very, very Irish, and they experienced a lot of racism. And so because of that, they were only allowed to speak English in the house. And so we grew up, like my generation grew up speaking mostly English and Spanish. A lot of our history was like not talked about. And so we're kind of just like Americanized, whitewashed in some ways, but like our food was like the only thing that like, I'm kind of acknowledging this like in this moment, that our food is like where we were connected to our history, our people. And that being said, like my grandparents only speak Spanish. So like there's, you know, there's that. But because of that, I wanted to learn more about my history. Like after high school, I was like, all right, what, like, why are we experiencing these challenges, you know, in this country? Why are we here? Why can't we? I want to go see what El Salvador looks like. I'm also half Mexican. I want to see what Mexico looks like. And so I really wanted to connect to my ancestry, and I wanted to travel. I wanted to go. I wanted to get the heck out of here. And so in undergrad, I found, I went to UMass Boston, which is right here in Dorchester. I think y'all pass by it. It's right on the water. It's very like urban university, right in the city, and very like liberal, progressive. Like there was some opportunities to get to do like service work in a different way than other other student works. So it's like learning and travel and service, but like you had to like learn about the history of the place before you went there, so to understand like the it was very like thought out. So I went on like 4 or 5 trips throughout undergrad to the Dakotas. I went to Mexico for the first time through that trip, through the student organization. And I also went to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And that trip to Guatemala was, the focus was youth empowerment. And it sort of ended up being like indigenous youth empowerment. And mm-hmm. so like, what does that really mean? And what does that look like? And so we went to Guatemala and it was like this white family that came from the US and like did Peace Corps there when they were younger. They built up like a home and some sort of program, some sort of nonprofit, the Community Cloud Forest Conservation. It's like CCFC, and it's in the highlands in Mount Chichen, Guatemala. So they learned the indigenous languages, and they work with them. All of these different communities in the mountains. And so going there, they had a program with youth, and it really like became not really a youth sort of focused trip. It was for me more about like the food, because it was about how they like sustain themselves in like these remote places, and how huge of an impact climate change is having on their community, but also because of how horribly the land is treated just by like all these big corporations that are taking and extracting from the land, and how that's directly impacting indigenous people, indigenous women, and indigenous girls. Mm. So it was very like sort of jumped like youth things and went straight to like how is what we're doing to uphold the food systems here in the US, but also globally, how is that impacting this land? And like seeing it in real life with like the hills broken, like these huge like mountains and stuff, like broken, and like you see the red of the inside of the like land, and like, you know, I didn't think it was red, I thought it was brown, like, but you know, how deep we go. But just to see that like Mother Earth is open in a way that she shouldn't be, like, got me to my core. So I was, that just sort of set me off of like, how did we get here, why, and just questioning a bunch of things, and wanting to like having the opportunity to be there and in like Mayan territory, which is my ancestors, for the first time, and seeing like what it's like today, and this is not okay. So that's sort of like what brought me to this work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you.
The imagery is really good.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Hi. My name is Lauren, Lauren McAllister. I'm a black farmer. And this story is definitely more than 3 minutes. I'm just gonna go ahead and say it. So knowing that time isn't real, and I'm starting there for a reason. So it was early August, and I was like, I'm gonna grow sweet potatoes. I have no idea why. Like, I'd never done it, had no idea how to. I discovered that my garden and most of the land in the back of our field has bindweed. And if you don't know what bindweed is, it has green leaves and it has a white, long root. Yes. I call it the colonizer plant because you just can't get rid of it. Yeah. And it, what it does is it sets this like 20-foot root, and then it wraps its leaves around anything and literally strangles it to death. Yeah. And so I was very defeated. I was like, I don't know what to do. And something just said, just grow some sweet potatoes. So I went out to this horse farm, and I moved to like, I don't know, 4 or 5 truckloads of manure from the horse farm. And I just laid it out there. And I forgot, because I'm that kind of farmer. And it became this easy, beautiful example of like going with what you don't know.
So then I buy all these sweet potato slips, and I'm like, okay, I can do this. And I just stick them in the ground. And I forget about them. Because, again, this is how I farm. Yes. Set it and forget it. And all summer long, so I set them around our wedding anniversary. And all summer long, I start having this dream. And I'm awake in this dream. And it's sunny outside. And I'm feeling the sun on, like, the lower half of my body. It's very warm. But I'm underneath this very tall stalk that has, like, a triangle shape at it. And I kept thinking, you know, I'm underneath, like, an umbrella, or I'm on the beach, please. Am I dreaming about the beach? Yes. So I was very excited about this idea that maybe I would travel or I'm going somewhere. And as the dream continued and it got more intense, and a purple flower appeared, and I just felt very warmed by this. And so I go to dig out the sweet potatoes, and I'm just crying my eyes out, like, harder than I've ever cried. And in fact, I was afraid to put my hands in the dirt because I didn't think any of the sweet potatoes had grown. So I had a very intense fear that I'd done all of this work and there might not be anything there. And I was wrong. I was more than wrong. There were so many sweet potatoes. They were so big. They were so wide. It was obvious that what I had done, it worked. And there was no bindweed at all. So the next day I get something in the mail, and I'm estranged from my family. So getting something in the mail, I was like, oh no. Literally, I was like, no, someone died and I have to go somewhere. It was very, like, disturbing. So I left it on my altar for like a week, and then I finally opened it up. And what no one had known in my family was what my great grandfather looked like, because he had been lynched. And so my great-grandmother ran from Macon, Georgia to Knoxville, Tennessee, because her husband and her dad had been lynched. And so they, in that envelope was a photo of my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother, Annie Mae Green, who was standing in front of her house the way that I do every day, and the entire bottom was sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. And so it occurred to me that this woman was crossing time to tell me in a very direct way, mm-hmm. you're the sweet potato.
Yes. Shufina Choti is mine. In Hashi, my opponent. Born and raised in southwestern Kenya, in Africa. And I grew up in a very rural community with a very rich culture. And my memories growing up is the time I spent with my cousins. My grandmother's house was our favorite change point because we could get all the cousins come and sitting around the fire and listening to the stories from our grandmother and, you know, eating the food together. And so that association, like getting the food, cooking, and also getting the stories. Remember the market days we could go with the grandmother to just go out and sell and exchange the foods and bring in others. So it was all food around us. So I'm a foodie because of that experience. But looking at the personal story that shaped my commitment to food sovereignty is related to migration. My coming to this country, I came as a student from the Fulbright exchange program. And so a young mother, three kids, my husband. And so nobody prepared us like what it is like here in terms of food. And so I didn't pack any food come here. It's just like suitcases, yeah. So there are many days that I went to the stores around where we settled in Atlanta, Georgia, and I couldn't find food. I walk through the corner stores, there's no food. Mm. And nobody to ask, like, where is really food that I can connect to? The one that I know that I need, because I love to cook, but I couldn't find it. And so I recall the many times I shed tears and went back to the house and I didn't find food. And then I started searching for a place to grow food that I knew. And in the meantime, I wrote back to my mom and say, I don't have food to feed the kids. And so what do I do? So my mom used to send me food. It is dry, so dry cocoa. Started gardening when I found a place, had seeds. And so moving to Melbourne, I wasn't in the food system. I was trying to respond in my personal way to fix the problem that my family had. Still, I was in the international space. I'm an educator working internationally. And just doing my gardening, which I love, from my grandmother, and fixing for my own family and sharing. But then in the moment of sharing, like when we get extra food, I'm a community person, I even buy food and I'm just like, let me share with people. I came across a woman during COVID. She had her hand wrapped up and I asked her why. And she gave me a story that was deeply personal. That she depended on the food pantry for food. And she went to the food pantry, got canned food, and got home, and she didn't have a can opener. Because in our culture, we don't do canned food. And so a can opener is not something that you will find in the house. We have knives. So she took a knife and was trying to open the can with the knife. And the knife missed the can and landed on her finger, and she cut her finger up and landed on urgent care, pool of blood in the house. And so she didn't even cook that meal and she was crying. Mm-hmm. And that touched me, you know, how much people are going through when you are in a culture unfamiliar and the food is unfamiliar as well. Mm-hmm. And that's when I made a decision to change my career and work in the food systems. Men did not believe that what I was doing. I said, I need to do this for my community. And that's when we started looking for land to start growing food. And so, and also advocating for culturally appropriate food. If you are a food system person, you know how important it is to make food diverse, but you know, these food banks, most of them don't know because they get donations from Walmart, from whatever, and they stock can and all this. But then the food, you get it because you don't have anything. But actually, when you get home, you can't use it if it's not within your culture. So that has really, you know, shaped my work in this. And also realizing that the land is not accessible. The land is controlled by a few people. They have chunks of land, but they can't give it for those who want to grow to grow. And so food sovereignty, land justice are issues that I'm deeply involved in. And it's part of, I think, liberation for our people. And that's why, that's my story.
Thank you. Okay, so I just have to name this. I feel like I'm Bob Barker on The Price is Right. Heather Eboy, she, her pronouns. I'm from southern southeast Alaska. I can't put this like that.
It's okay. I might have you start holding my phone though.
Hold your phone?
To speak into it, yes.
Oh.
Recorders now, if she did.
Okay.
Is dead?
So I guess my personal story of why I am deeply committed to food sovereignty is really rooted in relationships. And
privilege. And I feel very privileged to have been in relationship with my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, the way that I was. A lot of my time with her was spent outside on the land and harvesting. And I think that that kind of prepped me for being involved in food sovereignty. And I think my traditional cultures, the Tlingit and Tsimshian people, are a matrilineal society. And so our connection and the way that we trace through our mother's lineage is very important. And so my story, and I think I might have shared this with you all before, is really rooted around becoming a mother myself. And when I was pregnant with my son, gosh, it's been 16 years ago now, I really realized that things were changing so much so in our environment that some of the foods that I remember growing up harvesting and near and dear to my heart might not be available for me to be able to teach my son about and share with my son. There was this study done by this anthropologist, and it was she put together this little booklet. It was called Our Tlingit Foods Are Our Way of Life, and it was really looking at breaking down the nutrients of our local foods. And it's interesting to think about why that was needed. It was needed to be able to advocate in spaces that didn't understand being in right relationship with our non-human relatives. And so herring eggs, the herring come in and spawn usually in March, sometimes early April, it kind of just depends. And through mismanagement of state and federal agencies, herring used to spawn all up and down the coast of the region where I'm from, and those fisheries, or the commercial fishery, have really collapsed the populations all throughout the region, except for this one area around this community of Sitka. And there's this stronghold of herring spawn. And the tribe of Tlingit people, or the clan of Tlingit people that have such a deep relationship, are the Kiksati people. And Kiksati are my outer shell. And the reason that that's really important is because that represents my opposites, the people opposite to me. And they're very deep, social connections and things that come with that. And my son was just a baby. He must have been 8-9 months old, and we did baby sign language, because he wasn't talking yet. And so when the herring come in, we get these big boxes. People would send us these boxes, and we'd go pick them up at Air Cargo, and just such a joyous moment to share. And my son had his first bite of herring eggs in a room full of aunties, and I just will never forget how beautiful of a moment it was. Everybody saw that I went to go give him his first bite of herring eggs, and the room went, everybody held their breath. And my son, immediately after he, the crunch, crunch, pop, pop in his mouth, he said, more. Mm-hmm. And the room just, and just that sigh of relief that our connection to our foods, to our way of life, will continue on through the next generations. And just such a tremendous privilege to get to be a mom and to get to navigate the space that we get to be in our food systems. And thank you. I'm a crier. I think that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't know. I have to get new batteries, no, I guess. I'm Chantel. She, her pronouns. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, originally. I'm still in Brooklyn, so native New Yorker. And my story of food sovereignty started when I was like 21. I was kind of bouncing around from job to job, and I wanted to do something different, but I was tired of academia, and I was like, oh, maybe I could just like do something with my hands. And I was kind of like really open to like whatever that something was going to be, because I needed money and I was like, come on, something. and so like I was like doing odd jobs and stuff, and I found out about AmeriCorps, and I went through AmeriCorps, and my first introduction to urban agriculture was like growing food in public housing. And so up until that point, I had been like around public housing, like I lived around public housing, and I lived in public housing for a period, but it was still like a very stark separation because I wasn't like born in public housing. So like even just coming in is just like, whoa, like why are we living like this? You know, like what's going on? We're just trying to understand more about what's happening in the community and where I fit in. And I remember one time I was in the garden, and we were harvesting okra and collard greens and stuff. And I was helping one of the elders, and this butterfly was like flying all around. And it was this little kid, and he was so cute, I swear. Like he was just like the cutest little kid ever. And he was like, look, Farmer Chantel, this is the first butterfly I've ever seen. And it just broke my heart. It was like, what? You know, like, I took it for granted seeing and like being seen by nature. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, this is not gonna be like your last butterfly, you know? And even like before that specific moment, I was seeing like, you know, one seed is like so plentiful, so bountiful, yes, yes. And like understanding that. And then I'm just like, I don't get it. Like, I don't get why one seed is abundant and yet there is no abundance. Mm-hmm. I don't, like, the nature is providing everything and yet man is telling us that there is scarcity. And I was just so committed to that butterfly experience and having people understand about seeds and having people understand that there is no scarcity, there is abundance. Yes. And the only scarcity that we have is created. Mm. And that knowing and that teaching of that knowing to other people was what was transforming the community. It wasn't just like growing the food, it was people seeing like, it's not that hard. It's not that difficult. You know what I'm saying? I love what you said earlier, Lauren, about like being the lazy farmer, because it's like, it doesn't have to be this like high pressure, high intense. It really doesn't have to be all of that. It really can be put the seed in the ground and see what the land provides. And like being able to pass on that practice of like, it's not hard, and being the knowing, and that we need our kids to see the beauty of nature in order to see beauty within themselves. Yeah.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Emmanuel, and I go by Emma. He, them pronouns. And my story with food sovereignty, I think, is one of decolonization, or at least it has been up until now. I think it started with a story that Marta Silvia, my mother, likes to share with everyone, and is about when I was born and how I just wouldn't stop crying. And the nurses gave me a couple ounces of milk, which now I'm curious to know if it was actually breast milk or if they were already colonizing my taste buds, you know, from the beginning. But they gave me a couple ounces, which is apparently what they used to give folks back in the day when they were just born. And I still wouldn't stop crying. And they kept feeding me more and more until I ended up drinking like 8 or 10 ounces or something like that. And that's when I finally stopped crying. And there's I have mixed feelings about the story, and I think it also has shaped, you know, who I am and my relationship with food and all the healing that I need to do around it. And she says it with a lot of pride, so I do appreciate, you know, her, because that's kind of like a bragging point for her, you know, that a healthy kid was born, and that hunger kind of signifies, you know, how healthy I was and how big and strong I was going to grow up to be. And then throughout most of my life, I guess growing up in Mexico, I didn't have a lot of, I didn't pay a lot of attention to the food that we were eating. And what I can say was mostly homemade, which I really appreciate now, knowing that. And but there aren't a lot of memories about gathering, our family gathering around food. Even though we would eat, I guess the usual things. I suppose I just don't have any memories of food being what I now know it to be, which is, you know, what brings people together, whether it be in celebration or mourning or just holding space for each other. Food, it tends to be one that is something that, yeah, that is a societal glue that is very important. And then we fast forward to when I moved to the U.S., which happened around 1999. And what I remember from that time, because we came here on vacation, and then I just remember seeing parks with a lot of green grass, and I remember seeing schools that gave you breakfast in the morning, and I remember the food bank. This is one of probably the three things that I remember the most, the green spaces, the schools, and the food bank, which is a place we went to very regularly, and I actually look forward to it because it was a novelty, I guess, to go to a place where they just give you free food. But also because if my mother brought me with her, she would get sweet treats, and we would get, you know, Twinkies and cupcakes and whatever it is that they had as a treat, they would hold for people that would bring their children, which now I also have a lot of mixed feelings about. But yeah, that's just how it worked. So I did look forward to waking up at like 5 or 6 in the morning and then just standing in line at the food bank. It was also the first place that I volunteered, which is also something that was unfamiliar with, because just volunteering is not something that you do where I'm from. I remember the folks that would help us out being very kind, mostly older folks, and being very kind. And that kind of is what shaped my experience of a food bank back when I first came to the U.S., you know, a place that you'd go to that where you see or meet very kind people that would give you food. And now also, well, working at the food bank, where I get to actually do more of the intentional reflection and to kind of understand the maybe subtleties and the negative impact that all food banks also have. And now understanding that a lot of the food that we have, that we received back then, and that a lot of people receive now, it is very nutritionally deficient. You know, a lot of bread and a lot of carbs, very little fresh fruits and vegetables, a lot of canned food. And the meat that we used to get was mostly just, or the protein that we would get was just frozen meat, which, many negative things, I guess, to point out. But I also never realized and never noticed that most of the people, the older folks there, were white folks. And that also shaped a lot of my relationship and how, you know, for many years I would put white folks on pedestals because I saw them as, you know, people of abundance and people that would give you and that were very, very kind. But now also understanding that that there is a lot of problems with that, and how a lot of our food banks are funded by rich people, and they end up being the volunteers also that help at the food bank, and understanding how they get to shape the landscape, the political landscape, and they get to, I say laundering in quotations, because in some ways I do feel like it's like laundering money to kind of uphold the system that is broken. And in other ways, I do see a lot of them doing it from the kindness of their heart and believing that what they're doing is best, but not understanding that without community input, without people getting to choose, and without addressing, you know, the wider root causes of hunger, it's also creating a lot of harm. And through this process, I think the decolonizing of my relationship with food is what I know I'm understanding it to be, where I never got any either memories or recipes from. I mean, I have a large family, but I don't know that there are any recipe books or even many stories or pictures of folks. But I do feel privileged that I get to start my own. Like, I get to start my own recipe book, and I get to, you know, tell my own stories, and not only in the direction of generations after me, but I do trust that, you know, people before me are also going to speak through me in actually cooking with the fruits and fresh fruits and vegetables that they used to cook with, and I also believe that I get to hear, you know, their celebrations and their prayers, because I'm sure we had ancestors that were intimately connected with the soil and the land and the seeds, and that's where I think my work of decolonizing my relationship with food is that's where the most important work gets for me, and listening to the seeds and working with them and growing the food, preparing the food, and sharing the food, and hopefully, maybe sending, taking a picture or two for the folks that get to plant some of the seeds that I work with, and many generations from now, and then I get to be their sweet potato. Yeah.
Hello, my name is British Griffiths. My pronoun is that girl, she, her. I'll start off with a quote, which I believe is by Pearl Cage, and it's, "The problem with knowing is that you can't pretend you don't know." And so what has shaped my commitment to food sovereignty is the privilege and access to be able to travel internationally and being able to see how others around the world are connected with the world around them in a way that here in the US, there's a constant tug of war of access to food, resources, and just basic human rights. And another thing that was born out of my travels and experiences was understanding how political food is. And the younger me never really took that into account. And so every time I'm privileged to go abroad and come back to certain neighborhoods in the Chicagoland area specifically, the contrast around what markets are available in certain neighborhoods versus others is starkly, traumatically, like, just, it's so hurtful to see that these communities are designed this way, intentionally. And then to add on to that, we know that most of the folks in these neighborhoods who struggle to access a grocery store also don't have access to transportation and rely on public transit, which sometimes does not service these areas as frequently. So just understanding the interconnectedness between how access to food ties into other systems that don't have to, it doesn't have to be this way. And I know that because I've seen other nations function in a way where it's more cohesive. And public spaces are used to grow fruits and food and vegetation that folks can interact with directly. And so one of the things that like jumps out to me is during my time when I lived in Turkey for a little bit, I remember just walking around and like, oh, that's rosemary. And everybody's like, oh, you can take it if you want. And you're like, oh, okay. That's not like just being able to, one, have a country that is thinking holistically around the design of their green spaces and incorporating things that you can connect with and forage and not be policed or like nobody's frowning upon you doing certain things. That was one of the many things that shaped my commitment to food sovereignty. Thank you. Mm.